Okay, so we're going to talk about this Quantum Paradoxes book, right? Yep,
that's right. You're calling the shots. This is Dr. Jim Ranschler.
Speaking. Oh, it's nice to meet you, Jim. So, and the subtitle is Quantum Theory for the Perplexed. And you're supposed to be perplexed because it's quantum theory.
Aptly.
All right. And this is by Aharonov and Rorlich. I think I didn't butcher them very badly at all. However badly I do it, somebody's done it worse. So this is a book that I picked up mainly in support of modern physics when I was teaching that. So I wanted to look through this book and look at the paradoxes and hopefully find some good ways to approach quantum theory, even at the modern physics level, at the sophomore, junior level.
Yeah, maybe we should start with that. People would probably like to know what your background is a little bit. They should know that you're a teacher.
Well, I teach physics at Xavier University of Louisiana, which is here in New Orleans. My background in physics is not in quantum theory. My background in physics is in magnetization dynamics. Now, you studied physics at USC.
Briefly.
Okay.
And I've, you know, struggled forward ever since.
Struggled enough with it that we're here talking about this in your lovely studio that was recently hit by lightning.
Yeah, you know, lightning experiments can always go wrong.
I'm sure you'll refine it for the next go-round.
Yeah, I have big plans.
Okay. And, you know, I liked this book a lot, and even though I didn't get to use it for my modern physics class. And I think I gave it to you last year, or I'm not sure exactly how long ago it was, 6 months to a year ago, I think. Because you know, it's so interesting, and you know, you're always interested in physics, and you know, especially things where things aren't completely resolved, right? And then I guess over the summer I was reading it, because when I first tried it, I only got about halfway through, and I found out I was no longer going to be teaching modern physics, and I had to do stuff for work. So this was stuff for work originally, and then it got put into stuff for fun. And so this summer when I was reading it for fun, I just thought it would be a fun thing to do on a podcast when I was listening to other podcasts.
Well, paradoxes are always fun, and especially when it makes, you know, scientists look silly, or people that contemplate these things. And that's what they're designed to do, you know, to create a nice challenge conceptually for people can try to find new understanding. We talked a little bit about paradoxes last time. We talked about doing this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about how the Greeks had paradoxes, and it seems like my memories of the first paradoxes occurring in history seem to come from the Greeks, and so I think they were onto something. It's, you know, here we are 2,000, 3,000 years later, and we're still learning from paradoxes. It's a great way to distill a conceptual problem down to its simplest form so that you can see whatever fallacy is in there and maybe make some steps forward, or is in the case of the twin paradox, which we mentioned recently, to find out that there isn't actually a paradox. It's just the human intuition revolting at a novel idea of time.
And I think that's the reason why most things are paradoxes, is just because we don't really understand what we're talking about most of the time. And I'm not completely sure about that.
I feel that way all the time, by the way.
Yeah, yes. What, that you're not really sure about things? Okay. I think what we decided to do with this podcast was just go through this book chapter by chapter and sort of talk about things and get more and more confused chapter by chapter.
Yeah, it should be like a train wreck on audio.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we were talking about the Greeks and their paradoxes and all these things. Another book that I read over the summer that I'd had sitting around, and I hadn't finished previously, was a book just called Paradoxes by a guy by the name of Sainsbury. And that had a bunch of different paradoxes, the sort of normal sort of logic paradoxes. So there are a bunch of paradoxes that show that there's something wrong with logic or mathematics or something like that. And a lot of times people can't really figure out what is wrong with them. And he rated them on a scale of 1 to 10, in which case 1 was something that's what Aharonov and Rorlich are going to call an error, right? It's just, you know, you made a stupid mistake. I guess that would be a pseudo-paradox or a fallacy or something like that. In physics, you'd have something like this thing where you have two coins rotating, and you can, through some miracle of logic, even though they're connected and one has a smaller radius than the other one, you can purportedly prove that that the smaller one has the same radius or has the same circumference as the larger one, which is, you know, completely bogus. But it's one of these things that was attributed to Aristotle and took people a very long time of arguing to figure out.
Do you remember the specific form of that paradox? It would be interesting to contemplate.
I do not remember the specific form of that paradox. And I really don't want to talk about it too much right now, because I don't really completely buy every solution to it. But it's something like that, where it, you know, where the problem is pretty clear when you look at it. But it just took a little bit of work with geometry or mathematics, actually. I guess on the other side, he had at 10 level something like the liar, the strengthened liar, where you have a sentence that says this sentence is false. So if that sentence is false, then it's true. But if it's true, then it's false. And people have all sorts of ways to try to resolve it, but none of them are really satisfactory, right? You say, oh, well, you just can't use that sentence, right? Well, yeah, I can use that sentence. I just did. And you say, well, it doesn't really have meaning. Well, it does have meaning. I know exactly what it means. I just can't decide whether or not it's true or false. And you can say, well, you just shouldn't worry about whether it is or not. And then, well, maybe I shouldn't. But if I'm a logician, I probably should. And there are a whole category of things like that. Like, does the set of all sets contain its set of all sets that do not contain it themselves contain itself, which Jesus. Is Russell's paradox.
Yeah, logicians have a hard time on their hands. Must be a hell of a job. Fortunately, we're just going to look at the quantum physics of it, which is much simpler, of course.
Oh, well yeah. In fact, I think most of these would be pretty low on Sainsbury's list. I'm not completely sure. They get progressively more difficult to understand as you go through the book. You really have to understand things about weak measurements and things that are even less intuitive than standard quantum mechanics. Which, what was it? Feynman is, what did you remember what Feynman said about quantum mechanics?
Is it nobody understood it?
Well, something like that. And
I think he said, I think the exact quote had something to do with general relativity. I think he was denying that at any time that there was only 12 people that understood it. Because as soon as the paper went out, mm-hmm. you know, like Einstein for a while was the only one who understood it because he had the idea. But mm-hmm. once he published his paper, Feynman said, I'm sure that, you know, lots of people understood the theory at that point. But he said he's pretty certain that he can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics.
And from this book, I mean, it seems like that's completely true.
Yeah, and so, Feynman would be the one to believe.
Well, yeah. I mean, he spent a lot of time thinking about this a lot more deeply than I ever will, at least judging by the results.
Did he get a Nobel Prize? I think he did, didn't he?
Yes, he did, for quantum electrodynamics.
When you can invent an entire branch of physics, you get a Nobel Prize. That's awesome. All right, some of the things we're going to get into, I guess we're going to look at some of the paradoxes that people know of about quantum mechanics later on. We're probably going to touch on the Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah, and I think the Schrodinger's cat treatment here was a lot better than, say, in Townsend. So when I took quantum mechanics as an undergraduate, he does Schrodinger's cat in some chapter, I don't know, 7, 8. Don't quote me, I have no idea. You know, he gets into it at some point. There's a little picture of the cat, and it really just doesn't make any sense. Why is he doing it?
You always feel bad for the cat. I mean, you just can't help it. I mean, whether you hear the story or you see the illustrations of the poor cat living precariously at the whims of man's quest for physics understanding. Poor innocent victim of our quest. Yeah, there's a little touches on relativity a little bit here in the book, the quantum wave, this idea of superposition.
Well, yeah, I mean, eventually he does have to talk about relativity, and he does talk about it, and it's very important to how he's interpreting quantum mechanics. So Aharonov and Rohrlich, for the first 8 chapters or so, this book is using the paradoxes to illustrate what quantum mechanics is. But then for the last 10 chapters, it's really using the paradoxes to argue, I think, for a particular interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Right, and that's why I think you originally gave the book to me to read, because we had talked about the de Broglie-Bohm model,
mm-hmm.
and I think you saw parallels to the conclusion that he's making.
Yeah, so when I was originally reading it, it seemed very, very similar. After completely finishing this, it just seems similar.
Let's take a moment and talk about that briefly so that people can understand why we think this was interesting. I think that most people assume that there's a standard interpretation of quantum mechanics, that it's very counterintuitive, and that there seems to be a consensus, and we certainly use it as, you know, we engineer our materials with quantum mechanics really successfully, which is why we have the entire computer era. But there's a sense that there's a consensus on what it all means, or mm-hmm. if it means anything. Or in some cases, the idea is, you know, well, the math works, what else do you need? Mm-hmm. But there is actually a competing model out there, and an alternative interpretation, and there's a couple actually levels to that in the shadows, lurking in the shadows, that there may actually be some more sensible in the sense of being able to comprehend and understand a physical system at work behind the mathematics, which might make it more intuitively accessible. So that's really what, you know, what I find fascinating is when people can bring new conceptual models to something which seems like an intractable problem of mystery, you know, and the de Broglie-Bohm model seems like a great alternative explanation for quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. But for some reason doesn't seem to get much attention. Much of the attention that it does get seems to be overly hostile, but certain recent experiments, like the weak measurements that you touched on earlier, seem to provide evidence that this may be a really excellent way for students and professionals alike to perceive quantum mechanics as a physical system beyond the abstract mathematics that it's been used. You know, that it's been used to describe it. So that's, to me, the carrot of looking into a lot of these paradoxes and questioning our models of quantum mechanics. So that we'll hopefully get into a little bit of that as we go through, too.
They do talk a little bit about de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, but I don't think they do that quite as much. They talk more about what they think are their big competitors, rather than something that seems fairly similar. They're looking at these things that really say completely different things about quantum mechanics than what they do. I mean, we'll get into that in Chapter 9. I'm not sure if that'll all make sense right now. Yeah, they do spend a lot more time talking about what I think of as the Copenhagen interpretation, where you just, you know, shut up and calculate.
Right.
And the many worlds hypothesis.
Right.
Which has a completely different way of thinking about what's happening when you're measuring something in quantum mechanics than they do.
Yeah, there's a certain quality of attrition. You know, if you look at the various interpretations of quantum mechanics, if you take a hard look at it, those two models in particular, I think that you find it's difficult to digest logically, and to just kind of plant your flag with those interpretations if you're, you know, rigorously demanding a comprehensible model. So I guess by process of elimination, you end up with something akin to the pilot wave theory, which is the de Broglie-Bohm model.
Mm-hmm. When we get closer to Chapter 9, I think the Schrodinger's cat chapter is the same one where he starts talking about interpretations. When we get closer to that, I'll look up a book that I had that I have somewhere. I hope I still have it. I had a nice mathematical treatment of quantum mechanics and particle physics that had a really good chapter on interpretations. And in that case, he had 11 different competing interpretations.
Wow.
And so in, you know, 8 or 9 weeks, I'll bring a list of those, or probably I'll get you a photocopy of that, because it's a really old book. So it's one of these books that I picked up right when I started, I think before I even got to college proper, when I was in a community college and I was in the Marine Corps and all that other stuff. I picked up that book, and a lot of it I never really understood, but that part was one of the more interesting parts of the book.
That's where what I really love about science is where at the leading edge of science, you've got a conceptual art process happening. And I think that it's a testament to human reason and creativity that you can look at the experiments and the mathematics that we have today and come up with 11 different possible interpretations of that in completely different conceptual models. You know, and trying to figure out which one is more true, or which one has more predictive power or more applicability, that's an exciting journey.
Yeah, and I mean, the real reason why there are different interpretations is because nobody can actually use any of them to make a real prediction, right? If you could really use them to make real predictions, then all of a sudden you wouldn't have an interpretation, you'd have an experiment, right?
Right.
And if the experiment didn't work out, then that guy's off the table.
Well, yeah, so there's at least 11 competing equally, I guess, unpredictive, you know.
Yeah, but they all are compatible with standard quantum mechanics.
But ultimately, it's usually the 12th or 20th or 50th idea that somebody comes up with that actually entails a new experiment which makes different predictions than the standard interpretation would make, and suddenly you've got a revolution in science.
In these guys' favor, most of the papers that they're referring to for their own work come after the publication date of that book, right? So this is a different interpretation. Reading through it, it's definitely a different interpretation than De Broglie et Bohm, and it is something that came later. So maybe this is it.
Well, it could be it, I guess. I hope you can help clarify that as we get deeper into the book, because I've always been a big fan of the De Broglie Bohm model. They've done some great liquid drop experiments with oil droplets mm-hmm. on an excited surface of oil to create effects that, in a macroscopic level, that you can see with your eyes that resemble the phenomenon that we see with quantum mechanics. So that's always intrigued me. But if you can help me understand, because that's what I was looking for. I actually started in the middle of the book and read forward and was very disappointed that there wasn't really anything discernible to my mind in terms of a clear presentation of a model. It seemed a little too piecemeal, like they didn't ever seem to sink their teeth into, and here is our interpretation. So maybe you can help us put that together as we get further in.
Well, I think I can. I think I saw that a little bit at the end, and I'll do my best there. And obviously I'll try to get as much as I can out of these references.
This is where it's always very handy for an artist and an aspiring amateur physicist to have a real professional in the house to do get the wheat from the chaff.
Okay. Well. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good introduction to what we're going to do. So do you want to just talk about chapter one now?
Let's do it.
And see what we're doing. Okay, so the chapter starts off just saying a lot of the things that we were already saying, right? That, quantum mechanics is very successful. A lot of these effects that are really important, he doesn't talk about that, but a lot of these effects that are really important in solid-state physics are really quantum mechanical in nature. And completely wrong things happening if you don't understand quantum mechanics when you try to do solid state theory. And so, very successful theory that governs all of nature. It's governed by this fundamental constant, Planck's constant, make predictions very accurately with it. But at some point, right, when you actually start doing the measurements and you start looking at what's happening with interference patterns collapsing, no longer being interference patterns because you've modified your experiment a little bit, it just doesn't really make any sense why that would happen. Right? It does happen, and you can rigorously prove it happens, but the actual rationale behind it is strange.
Well, let's start with a couple of things. First of all, let's mention for people who might not be intimately familiar with quantum mechanics, that there's kind of a myth that it's only relevant to these incredibly small scales. It's only relevant to an electron. It's only relevant to, an atomic nucleus, things of that scale. But like we mentioned earlier, ferromagnetism, every refrigerator magnet that you've got is exhibiting a quantum mechanical effect. And superconductors, MRI machines, this is a superconductive technology, and this is a quantum mechanical technology. So it's increasingly getting real world, large scale applications. So there's that. where were you with that?
Oh, well, this is just where he's starting. And Aronoff and Rohrlich, they quote Wheeler and they say, there's going to be no progress physics when you don't have a paradox, right? If you don't see any place where you don't understand what's going on, where you have something that you think you understand and it leads to a conclusion that is wrong for whatever reason, then you're not going to get that progress in physics. So the classical paradox is you have two assertions, a couple of assertions that you think are really well grounded, right? And you put them together and you get something that you know is wrong. Right.
Right.
Like, we were talking about Zeno's paradox, right?
Sure.
Right. You say, okay, well, it makes a lot of sense that before Achilles can catch the tortoise, he has to go that entire distance, right? From where he is to the tortoise. But the tortoise is running too, right? So the tortoise has moved a little bit, so he's no longer where he was when Achilles was trying to catch up with him. So now Achilles has to catch up with him again, right? And that makes sense, right?
That was the original form of Zeno's paradox?
That was the original form of Achilles and the tortoise. And you keep on doing that. No matter how many times you do that, there's another time you have to do that. And so obviously Achilles can't catch the tortoise. But everybody knows Achilles can catch the tortoise. So what is the problem with what you're saying, right?
Right.
And there are plenty of ways to attack it. And I, like I said, Zeno has several paradoxes, at least five that I know of off the top of my head.
Oh, okay.
That have to do with motion. He might have others that don't have to do with motion. But in every case, the paradoxes that he has to do with motion, they're making some assumption that's directly contradictory with what we think and have thought since, you know, Huygens. Every single one of Newton's laws of motion, he thinks he's gotten rid of through his paradoxes. So we know there's a problem, we just have to identify where the problem is. And I think most people with Zeno's paradoxes, most people seem to agree that the problem has to do with how Zeno treats infinity. He isn't using it correctly. And the correct way to use infinity is all this calculus stuff that Newton was going to get around to inventing, you know, 2,000 years after Zeno died. So if he didn't have those things to play with, then it's okay to have those problems. But philosophers still think that, you know, there's something to Zeno's paradoxes. And I'm not sure I agree with them, but they do seem to think there's something in there, and they liked arguing about them. I've got a book called Zeno's Paradoxes that are just a bunch of papers of philosophers arguing about Zeno's paradoxes. And again, I can't follow a lot of their reasoning because it's really all about the logic of infinity rather than the mathematics.
Right. Well, I think when you use language, you can create paradoxes where there may not be one based on your definitions, you know, to conventional understanding. Math seems to be a little, you know, less prone to presenting insolubilities.
Well, this other book, the book that I was reading when you came and saw me at Mojo earlier.
Mojo being our favorite coffee shop.
Which is, you know, just downstairs, basically. That book, Paradoxes and Probability, said that there were like 80 probability paradoxes and a whole bunch of set theory paradoxes. And I was just reading the introduction, and it was saying there are lots of these things out there. And I don't know what their status is because, you know, I just read the introduction of a book, so I don't have any idea what the status of these things is. But there are a lot of them that don't have good answers in mathematics where people are very, very careful about how they define things, right?
Right. That's fantastic.
So they still show up. And it seems to me that the closer you are to the mathematical thing and where they show up, the harder it's going to be to actually find some resolution. And obviously the cooler it is, right? Because
yeah.
Got a really clear idea about what you're talking about.
And it still doesn't make any sense.
It still doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think the original paradox of it, you know, I think Feynman said that this is the thing that you always come back to when you're talking about quantum mechanics. The most perplexing paradox that kind of started all of the quantum mystery was the double slit experiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got a wall with two slits cut out of it, and you're going to shoot a photon or an electron through these slits. You could imagine that if you had a bunch of them all going through, they could interfere with each other to create an interference pattern on the surface behind the slits.
Mm-hmm.
But when you fire the individual particles through one at a time, they still create an interference pattern. So it's sort of a logical paradox. How can you get an interference pattern when you're sending one particle through at a time? And then we end up with quantum mechanics trying to explain that simple thing.
Yeah, so how can something interfere with itself?
Yes.
So yeah,
when it's not...
This one little electron that's supposed to be a point particle.
Right.
Right, that has a radius of less than 10 to the minus 22 meters, but its electric dipole moment is smaller than some value, which means it's very, very round. If it has a radius, it's incredibly round.
And these numbers are just kind of indicating what are the limits of our ability to measure.
And it's just the limits of the ability to measure.
Right.
And there was a science article earlier this year. So anyways, that double slit experiment with these particles, it doesn't make a lot of sense if you keep thinking about the electron as a point particle, which we just said we think it is. But
we're down to how small? 10 to the minus 22nd.
Yeah, that's much smaller than the distance between atoms, okay, in a material. You're not building two slits that are that far apart. I mean, when you're building slits, you're talking about billions and billions of, maybe not billions and billions, maybe just 20 or 30 billion times larger than that as your minimum slit distance.
Chunk change.
Yeah. No, it's actually more than that. Maybe it's a couple trillion.
The width of the slit, you mean?
Yeah, the distance between the slits is your minimum, and then you know most of the things that you'd actually use would be 200 to 1,000 times larger than that. So differences between how small we think that electron is and the size of the slit is huge. It's longer than you know your height compared to your walking distance if you decided to walk to Moscow over the Arctic Circle.
But it's got a big field, you know. It's infinite, right? Ultimately,
his wave function is infinite in some sense of the word infinite.
So the presence of the electron may be interfering with the apparatus as it goes through. Is that it?
Interfering with the apparatus, interfering with itself. I don't understand it, and we'll spend a lot of time not understanding it. Hopefully, by not understanding it, we'll understand it better. And I don't remember exactly where he starts talking about it, but we will have a really in-depth conversation about this in 2 or 3 weeks, right? Because it doesn't take him long to start talking about these interference effects, and I'm not sure if it's going to be in Chapter 2 or Chapter 4 or Chapter 3, but it'll be somewhere in there. So we do have those sorts of problems, and those are going to be at the forefront of what we're going to talk about. Let's see. Now, in this first chapter, Aharonov and Rohrlich sort of categorize these
let's go over the types of paradoxes.
The easiest one is an error. You just goofed. You know the way you're interpreting whatever you're interpreting is just wrong, right? Period. The second one was a gap. That seemed to me to be mostly where you have two physical theories for different aspects of physics, right? And they don't really fit together the way you want them to. You can't figure out how they fit together, and something weird happens when you try. Or possibly I think when they're talking about the black holes, the results of one theory contradict the results of the other theory. But both of those theories both seem to be right. So you just haven't integrated them well.
Right, and somebody's got to come up with a brilliant little bridge which ties them up neatly together, and suddenly both theories are stronger because they've both expanded into each other.
Yeah. And then you have real contradictions, right? Like that liar paradox, which are unresolved. You have unresolvable differences, between theory and experiment, somewhere inside of the theory. Everything seems to work right except for this one interesting case, and you can't figure out why.
Yeah, it seems like the case of contradictions is nice because I get the impression that when they're most exciting, you've got two different types of calculation which predict different answers. Then you've got something that you can actually test.
Yeah. Well, that is the best result as far as a physicist is concerned, right? Is if you can take two theories that cover the same thing, right, and you can get different answers, then you can get a real physical test. You can do a real experiment.
Right.
Or at least in principle, you can do an experiment. And if you can't do an experiment now, people will spend a lot of time figuring out how to cool the atoms down enough to do the experiment, right? Or whatever it is.
I love the that's kind of the nagging thing about quantum mechanics that I love, is that it keeps making outrageous predictions that nobody believes will happen, and then they successfully run the experiment and create those effects.
Oh yeah, that whole Bell's theorem thing is wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And quantum entanglement and all that other fun stuff.
Oh yeah, we're gonna quantum teleport some information to a distant particle at infinite speed, apparently. Sure, but you know, technically we're not transferring information, but you know, we've created a twin of this thing at a remote. And how does that happen? You know, the spooky action at a distance, it's still spooky.
If you think about it, it just doesn't make any sense, but it happens anyway.
Yeah, but it makes, it's a terrific breeding ground for new ideas, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you see experimental confirmation of things happening at speeds faster than the speed of light,
mm-hmm.
like this effect,
mm-hmm.
Quantum tunneling and all kinds of things like that, it really makes you start to question the bedrock of your understanding of the universe, and that's a good place to be.
Well, yeah. I mean, if your understanding of the universe is all based on macroscopic stuff, then you're wrong about everything. Right. that's just the way it is.
You know, it's funny, mystics would say the same thing. I think that's where everybody can agree on no matter which fringe you're on, the fringe of theoretical physics or the fringe of the paranormal investigator, you know, you come to a similar conclusion that it's those people in the middle that are all all backwards. What I loved about this contradictions chapter here was a very clear example that it gave, which was pretty wonderful, the paradox of the ether.
Oh, yeah, the ether was one of these things that really had to exist.
Right. It gave you, you know, your all of your measurements of motion. Mm-hmm. It was the absolute rest frame, right? Mm-hmm. And that everything moved relative to this ether. Mm-hmm. And when Einstein challenged that, I guess what was Einstein challenged that, that they really felt there was the drive to tell, okay, which is it? Is there an absolute reference frame or not? And so they ran the Michelson-Morley experiment, and we have our answer.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Michelson-Morley...
Two models compete, right? Two models are making a prediction.
Yeah, the Michelson-Morley experiment. I mean, when it was made, it was just a sort of confirmation. Right. It was not something where they expected that there was any other possibility, because at that point it had been well established.
That was pretty late, wasn't it? 1887.
Yeah, 1887. This was like 20 years before Einstein's special theory of relativity.
Oh, yeah.
So the experiment, its whole idea was just to confirm the presence of the ether. They said, okay.
They believed that they'd measure a difference in this?
Yes. They just wanted to confirm the presence of the ether in a really strong way. And the reason why they wanted to do that was because it was something that was predicted by the theory, and the theory was really strong that it had to exist, right? You have electromagnetic waves. Well, what are waves? Waves are things that propagate in a medium.
Right.
So there has to be a medium. And we know that
how can you transmit light as a wave if it's not exciting something?
That's right.
So ether was the thing that was exciting.
And so this wave has to propagate in the medium at the speed of light c, just the way sound travels through the air to you at the speed of sound, because it's just a constant, right?
But there were these paradoxical properties that it would need to have, right?
Yeah.
There'd be no resistance moving through it, because you wouldn't feel the ether as you moved, and yet it had to be so many times denser than solid steel in order to transmit vibrations at that frequency.
Yeah, it had all sorts of weird things about it. And, you know, it couldn't interfere with things because, you know, obviously you're getting all these electromagnetic waves coming out of the sun. So that means you have to have a lot of this ether stuff. And when the Earth is orbiting the sun, can't feel any ether resistance.
Right, there's no friction with ether.
Because otherwise it's going to spin down into the sun and we're all going to die really quickly, like well before we ever existed. So there were these strange properties, but people were willing to believe it because, I mean, how else do you have a way? And so they just wanted to confirm that. Then they didn't find it, and they were very upset.
Yeah, this is interesting. They had mentioned Einstein here because early on, even the 16-year-old Einstein had concluded, without knowing, I guess, about the Michelson-Morley experiment, he'd already concluded that there was no ether. And he writes this incredibly eloquent statement about it. It's 16. It's like, if you ever wondered if he was really a genius back to his teens, yeah, he didn't come out as a 25-year-old genius. Suddenly, he was mulling over advanced physics issues from his youth.
Yeah, actually, you don't need that. You really only need the principle of relativity, that is Galilean relativity, and you need the constant speed of light. And if you have that, actually, that's all you need to get to special relativity.
Yeah, at 16, you already tied those two together in that quote there.
And another thing, I think the thing that I find really interesting is both of those things that I just said were known
for a long time
by at least 1700, by at least the 17th century, so 16 something or other. Both of those things were well known, and it took people hundreds of years until you got to Einstein to actually figure that out. So if you don't think that it's if you don't think you need a genius every now and then, special relativity proves you're wrong.
Well, it's been a century and we're still waiting for the next major breakthrough. Maybe there's a 14-year-old Einstein out there now working on the big breakthrough. In a couple years, he'll write his first eloquent statements about it.
Probably he's playing Grand Theft Auto. That is something that is really, really an interesting story. And special relativity is going to show up in here as well. Quantum electrodynamics is...
That's applied special relativity, really.
That's quantum mechanics and special relativity thrown together. They're together. I mean, I guess a lot of people know that general relativity and quantum mechanics don't fit the way we'd like them to. But sometimes people don't realize that special relativity works really well with quantum mechanics, and it's actually quantum electrodynamics stuff is one of the best verified theories out there. So,
thank you, Dr. Feynman. All right.
I think that's most of what we had. I mean, we could talk about the errors with the triplet paradox that he was talking about before, or we could talk about Maxwell's demon and black holes.
Maxwell's demon has a great name. It's kind of a boring thought problem when you look at it.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a demon opening a door, letting the fast particles through, and closing the door on the slow ones. We were talking about the twin paradox the other day. How does that come up in this book again?
It's an example of an error.
And the error, okay, let's talk about the twin paradox briefly, because that's a fun paradox or non-paradox.
The basic twin paradox is you have some guy on Earth, or you have two guys, because they're twins.
This just highlights the paradoxical quality of it.
Yeah, so one guy just sits there and stays on the Earth, or the other guy gets on a spaceship and rockets off somewhere real fast, picks up a beer at Alpha Centauri, and then comes back.
A hell of a trip for a beer, but...
But, you know... Neil's only reason to go to Pennsylvania is for Yingling. So people will do that.
Oh, jeez.
So if they had good beer in Alpha Centauri, people would do this. But from what I've heard, they don't.
They may. We should find out.
Yeah. Maybe. So one twin goes off to get the beer and then comes back.
Right.
Traveling very, very quickly. Very, very quickly to Alpha Centauri. I mean, that takes him 6 years. When the twin comes back,
Traveling twin makes it back. He's younger.
Yeah. So he ends up being younger than the other twin. But you're talking about relativity, so this is where people see the paradox. You know, if one twin is moving and, you know, in his own reference frame, you know, the other guy is moving.
Right. If their motion is Galilean relative, then how can one age slower?
Well, I mean, if they're special relative, if it really is relative, how can one be younger than the other? Because even given that you have Lorentz contraction, even given you have time dilation, the whole situation from the point of view of one of these guys should be the same as looking at from the other guy.
Right, that their points of view should be equivalent in theory, but that's missing something.
Mm-hmm.
That's missing the change in reference frame, right?
That's a big thing here is that you do have a change in reference frame here, right? When the guy turns around at Alpha Centauri, that makes the problem no longer symmetric in some way because now you have three reference frames, right? You have three reference frames and one guy is in two of them while the other guy is just in one. You know, one guy has one velocity in one part of the problem and another velocity in another part of the problem, whereas the other guy, he doesn't change his velocity at all.
Right, he stays in his original reference frame. Yeah. So there actually is there's a physical difference between the traveling twin and the one that...
There is something physically different about that. And I think what we were talking about, a lot of people do, and even when in my modern physics class when I was an undergraduate, this is how it was presented to me.
Yeah, there's still a lot of confusion about this simple paradox, really.
The guy there was trying to explain that it was because there's some acceleration at this point.
Right, and I'd read that online and fallen for it, hook, line, and sinker.
Well, I mean, it makes sense because that's the asymmetric part. Got this asymmetric effect, so you want to look at the asymmetric part of the problem, right? And that is an asymmetric part. The problem with that is, you know, if you were doing it that way, all of that aging would really have to happen here.
Right, and it doesn't, and we know that. It's not the turning around that makes the aging, because if he travels longer, if he goes 10 light years away to Betelgeuse or something, and comes back, he's actually going to have a much bigger age difference. So it's not just the turning around that does the aging.
That's right.
It's his time spent in that other reference frame that's in motion.
Well, yeah.
Because he's experiencing a different rate of time because he's experiencing a rate of space, which is different.
So the way to look at it is the sort of the path length that he takes to get to the same spot, right? Because they come back together is longer.
Right, he's gone through more space, I guess, mm-hmm. or more time, both, actually.
Yeah, he's gone through more of this space-time to get there. So this path length is longer, and that actually is the thing that makes it smaller. So the proper time for this path length is smaller than the proper time for this path length. And proper time just means the time felt by the person along the path. And that's an important concept because it's invariant. It doesn't matter who the person is. If you do the calculation right from any reference frame, proper time for each person should be the same. It's all that proper time means. It's proprietary. It's your time. You always have your time, and everybody should agree on how much time you spend in your frame using things that they can measure in their reference frame. And actually, you know, all of the complicated things that I was doing, I don't really have to do. You can do it actually fairly simply. If you just look at the Earth's time...
Okay.
If you look at the amount of time the twin that stays on the Earth is the same, stays there, and you assume that this guy has the same speed as measured by this twin going away and coming back, the twin that moves, his time is, you know, the sum of the time in the first leg plus the time in the second leg, right? Okay. And to get to the proper time that the guy on the Earth would measure. Minus v squared over c squared, excuse me. This guy would measure that it would take, the guy on the Earth would measure t over 2 to get, it takes the other guy t over 2 to get to this spot because it's halfway through the...
Oh, right.
It's halfway through the path, right? So half of the time for the guy who's going to Alpha Centauri is spent going to Alpha Centauri.
But this gets even more complicated, doesn't it? Because the brother on Earth, he won't see the event of his brother arriving at that distance.
No.
Until much beyond that, much past the middle of the trip.
They like to do things when you're doing this, showing light beams and stuff in the Minkowski space and showing you how many years it takes in each spot.
You're talking about the proper time, and so they've already accounted for that and derived it using the laws of special relativity.
Yeah.
So they can predict that even though they haven't seen you arrive there, mm-hmm. today he's arriving, even though it seems like he's still on his way.
Yeah, so you don't actually need to do all this complicated stuff with little light beams. It's fun to do that. You don't have to do that.
Okay.
In a class, I would do this the other way. I would go through this entire sketch with the light beams and then derive this 1 minus v squared over c squared, the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared.
That's your time dilation factor, also known as Lorentz contraction, right?
Well, Lorentz contraction is the spatial.
The quantities are the same. The proportion factor is always the Lorentz transform, right?
Yeah, so they're both parts of the Lorentz transform.
So you could take the Lorentz transform times just the observer on Earth, his time, to understand how much less time passed for the traveling.
All right.
I love it when they use beta instead of v squared over...
That is a nice way to do it, you know, if you're doing an entire class on special relativity or something
right.
like that. But if I'm talking with students and you've only got 2 weeks of special relativity or something like that, I've found that just confuses them more. Okay. Well, I think I'm going to have to go talk to my wife.
It's that time.
It is that time.
Time flies.
Okay, so I'm going to leave you here in your hedonistic studio of math and physics.
Okay, sculpture, math, physics, and the lightning strike in my ceiling.
Yeah, and that's awesome.